Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. Today I talk with Jeff Nicey. Jeff is a senior lecturer for engineering, computer, and mathematical sciences at the Auckland University of Technology. He is also a Bitcoiner, and we discuss how he has been teaching Bitcoin to his students, including sharing Satoshi's white paper and exploring the technology of the Lightning Network. We also discuss some of the challenges that come with bringing new ideas to academic institutions. Jeff is also on the Executive Council of Blockchain NZ and hosts their own podcast, and I'm glad to hear that we have a Bitcoin voice in that group. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you'd like to support the show, please consider streaming some Satoshis via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform such as Fountain or Breeze. Otherwise, on to the show. Yeah, these microphones are pretty good, but you've got to be careful sometimes, like you get the ASMR going if you get too close to it, so no worries there.
Yeah, boom mics for the win, for sure. You don't have external shocks on the table and stuff like that.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty happy with this Rode PSA arm. It just sort of keeps it separate from my hands and stuff, so it's pretty convenient. But hey, I appreciate you making the time, Jeff, to catch up and talk about Bitcoin and sort of what you're doing up at AUT. So keen to jump into it and sort of learn a little bit about sort of where you're at the moment, what you're doing. I understand you're a senior lecturer for engineering, computer, and mathematical sciences up at AUT. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's the day job title.
Yeah. And beyond that, though, you're also involved with a bunch of other stuff in the space. Can you give us a bit of an overview of that, please?
Yeah, sure. No worries. Yeah. So my day job, like I say, it's mostly teaching physics to like introductory engineering students. But then a few years ago, I got into blockchain. And as most people do, when they start to unwind that white paper by Satoshi, it leads to more and more and more and more. And basically, I wanted to just stop everything I was doing professionally and try to first of all, learn more about blockchains, learn more about Bitcoin. How does it work? Why is it so good? Why does it work? And then incorporate that into my life here at the uni. I'm a senior lecturer here. And in 2019, I put together a paper for students. You know, I was looking around and we didn't have anything on offer for students to take to, you know, so much as even like see the word Bitcoin in a syllabus. There was nothing. So I kind of put up my hand and said, hey, why don't we have something like this? It's like a pretty hot topic. And so that's grown quite a bit. We now have two classes here at AUT, one for undergrad students and one for master's students. And I'm just getting ready for them. They both start for the year. They both start in July for semester two. And so that's kind of on the professional end. And then more on the personal side as well, I'm involved with Blockchain New Zealand a little bit to, you know, meet people around local community and try to contribute and to try to see what's happening and, you know, just really keep my ear to the ground to figure out what's happening in New Zealand.
Yeah, that's cool. And where are you originally from?
I am from Canada. That is where my some of my intonation comes from. Yeah.
No, that's all good. I was just I was on a call with another guy. Actually, he's originally from Canada as well. So that sort of I thought, oh yeah, there's something there. But something I want to dive into, Jeff. You talk about the white paper Satoshi. You know, that's been 13, 14 years now that Bitcoin has been running. But you also talk about blockchain, and I do want to just dive into that a little bit because I think, obviously, blockchain technology is used in Bitcoin, but there's a lot more to it than that. How do you sort of square the difference between, you know, what blockchain is as a technology, but at the higher level, the transformative power of Bitcoin? Like, how are you able to make that work within an academic context?
Yeah, I think I come at it just from a tech perspective. So it's fine. I come at it primarily from the tech perspective. So it's fine to talk about Bitcoin, but rather than talking about, you know, all of the implications and the broader, you know, the broader good that Bitcoin can do for everyone, although that gets a strong mention, I much more am curious about concentrating at the technical level. You know, this one class I'm talking about is situated in the computer science department, which may seem like it's not that unique, but it actually is. If you look at the offerings that are around, most of the other ones are sort of outside of a technical subject. They're more in like a business school or a law school. And of course, that includes a lot more of the social implications. But in terms of like squaring this idea of like blockchain with Bitcoin, I mean, I have no problems talking about blockchain all day long, as long as I'm like pegging it back to where blockchain came from, right? There's no blockchain without Bitcoin. And going back to this idea of like basically a proof of work distributed system, you know, to secure global value transfer. And people are like, whoa, there's a lot there. And we can unpack all of it at a technical level. And so that's where it fits in academically for me. And I've definitely seen other people tackle the other aspects socially.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because I certainly think that's sort of where I come at it from, and that's where we can have these interesting conversations. You know, the podcast is called The Transformation of Value, and I'm really looking at, you know, the power that Bitcoin has, you know, blockchain being just one small piece, I think, of a much broader, you know, there's the consensus mechanism, there's all these pieces to it, which blockchain alone, you know, if it's centralized, you might as well have a database, right, is the classic argument. And I think... I can appreciate though where that comes from. You know, you do need to have a clear syllabus that's repeatable. You know, you don't necessarily want to be updating it too much year to year. Otherwise, it's a lot of work just for, you know, and academic staff already very busy with, you know, doing their own research, teaching, tutorials, all of that stuff. And so having, you know, a fundamental technology piece that you can kind of reference back, you know, back to, I can see that really working. Though I'm also curious, I mean, with your students, sort of what their take is on it, you know, are you finding, like, how are they coming to the class? What sort of preconceptions are they bringing? What are their thoughts on Bitcoin in particular, but also more broadly sort of blockchain and that sort of thing?
Yeah, just one more thing about blockchain, right? Like, to me, blockchain is the idea of the decentralized system. And so as you mentioned, and I had sort of a giggle, right? This idea of like a centralized blockchain, or like they call them enterprise blockchains, right? and like it's fine. There's something, and some people can do stuff with them, and they might have purpose, right? But from my point of view, like, you know, academics need to be rigorous with our language and our definition. And those don't fit the bill for blockchains. So it's great to talk about those differences, but I'm not spending any time, you know, talking about like what Hyperledger is up to, you know, or even like what Binance and their smart chain is up to, right? Like their validators, it's on such a limited network. You can't just jump in and join the Binance network like that. But in terms of like my students, like one of the like tremendous privileges about being a teacher is that you get this like new group of students, right? This continual churn of clients and relationships that you work with. And so you never know what the next group is going to bring. And so kind of to generalize, the students are curious from a like meme coin point of view. So, you know, day one might be like, oh, sir, have you, what do you know about Dogecoin and like things like this, right? Because they're, you know, as younger people than myself and slightly younger people than yourself, right? They're a lot more tuned into like these social metrics and how it's being carried in social media. And so that's where we start. And it's like, great, we'll talk about that as well. But in terms of like the broader picture, a lot of them also, you know, are just starting to learn about this. So we have to take some time to talk about like why a blockchain is a good idea for money, you know, because that in itself, you know, is a really big hurdle to get over. Like we already have money. Money seems to work pretty well. What do you mean we need money on a blockchain? And that's not even sticking with the technical concept, right? Because, you know, money is like a social technology. And so this is also sort of what makes teaching Bitcoin and blockchain, like, I guess, you know, really a challenge. And same for anyone that's learning it. There's so many different bits to put together.
Yeah, that's I can appreciate the challenge with, you know, especially undergraduate students who are perhaps quite new to the world. You know, maybe they haven't even had a proper job before, they've only worked part-time. There's a certain political and economic consciousness that's required to fully understand the implications of Bitcoin, and that sort of comes back to what we were talking about before, that it can actually be quite challenging to push that all through and communicate that, when it's like, really, the questions, these are metaphysical questions around value, around freedom, around justice, around what is money, these kinds of things, which, you certainly will struggle to appreciate that, I think, as a young person, and with limited time, engagement every week, it's almost like, where do you start? I mean, the white paper is a great place, but it certainly doesn't go into full detail, and maybe these people are got student loans, they'll just sort of think, well, it's all good. They haven't even maybe had a chance to vote or anything, and it's like, I can appreciate that there is a challenge there to communicate that the value proposition, just as there is with trying to talk to anyone about it.
The value prop, just like you said, man, like that is so difficult. And, it's difficult for grown folks here in New Zealand. It's a beautiful country and a lot of things are really great about this place. And, you might have to pay a few extra fees to use PayWave, but trying to convince, student and an adult alike that this value proposition, is quite revolutionary and isn't going away, and that, the world is much larger than just how good we have it here. But about the students and generally, they're quite young. I think back to like my own, I guess journey, that's a bit of a cliche word, but when I was like learning about money, like it's taken me years as a like casual outside observer. It started with the GFC, just like watching the news and being like, what's going on here? Why is this such a big deal? Like, who cares if a bank collapses? What do you mean? What's a mortgage, right? And I was university aged and had no idea. And I'm still working my way around it when I try to like untangle things that happen in finance and business and like what it means for most people. And so just to be thrust in on day one, like, I used to do history. Like lecture one was like, we'll go back to the Medicis in Venice, and we'll talk about double entry bookkeeping, right? And now it's more of a footnote. Now I start with I just go online and I like Google blockchain, and I take like the first few hits, and I just start creating like a lexicon of things that we have to learn about before we can understand it based on what we see online.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And I, as I said earlier, I do appreciate there's some challenges there to communicate it, because the other thing, and I'd love to hear your perspective on this, is within the academic institution, and obviously there are individuals within that, but there is certainly an organizational bias towards certain things. And, the power of Bitcoin is something that's extremely, the idea, it's a very powerful, almost challenging idea, and for an organization to adopt that and to think about that, I've often thought they need to kind of break it down into these more consumable pieces, because when you zoom out and you come in and say, well, Bitcoin fixes this, Bitcoin fixes everything, if Bitcoin fixes the world, these kinds of ideas that I think you can come to when you really follow the rabbit hole, to try and then say that, to bring that to the to academia is almost it's a challenge, and it can almost be a daunting task. You might find it challenging to be that radical. I'd love to hear your sort of thoughts on that, though.
Are you suggesting that like it's an old institution in a brick building that's hesitant to adopt and change?
Yeah, and I mean, that's me looking at it, from having gone through it myself. But I mean, I'm sure AUT's got something nicer than brick, but like, is there truth to that at all, or would you say they are quite responsive?
You're absolutely right. There is truth to it. I think we are catching up. I think 7 years ago, just to pick a number, it was a much different story at universities. Only a select few pockets globally that were doing anything, and they were probably seen as quite radical in their own right. Nowadays, I would say there's at least one person at every institution that is keen, again, to generalize in round numbers. But still, it, it can be, when you're in an institution, it can be difficult to get traction on these broader issues, right? Like you have a strict management structure. There's a way that funding applications work. You know, there's a way that the hiring process works, which is much larger than any individual person. So when you're trying to take this idea of like a super sovereign individual and, you know, monetary value transfer and push it into an institution, I think definitely at first, a lot of people are going to look away and be like, oh yeah, Jeff, he's working on Bitcoin. Sometimes, you know, at the water cooler, I'll get like, so are you still doing that Bitcoin stuff? And I just kind of go like, yep.
Yeah. Well, I think that institutional capture is something that I've certainly felt. You know, I went 2 years ago, I went back to do a bit of study. I took up a Chinese paper. I spent a little bit of time in China, and I just wanted to formalize my language skills a little bit more. And I realized just how much, even in the years that had gone since I did my study, how much that the revolution, so to speak, had moved on from the ivory tower. And so there's nothing left as far as I could see, you know, like, everything had been prescribed. Everything was about job security for teaching staff. You know, it's very problematic for staff and tutors to maintain their jobs. And so anything that sort of steps outside the lines, whatever they may be, here in Wellington at Victoria University, it's certainly got some very clear lines about what is and isn't acceptable to talk about. And it's like that idea of critical discourse, which was supposed to emerge from universities, has sort of moved on in a way, and it's like the brick has stayed behind, and the lecture theatres are still there, but you couldn't really stand out and say anything that went against the grain, as far as I could see.
You're definitely right. The pendulum has, in my eyes, swung to the other side. You know, there's only two sides it can swing to, but it's gone to this side, like, yeah, in favor of job security. And also, you know, in America, it's all about the DI, the diversity, inclusion, and E for equity. The acronym's phrase,
DI.
Phrase the other.
Yeah,
DI is the negative way to phrase it. It's actually phrased another way, right? That hasn't, in that context, that hasn't hit New Zealand yet. But you hear like remarkable stories about, you know, about like, an applied physicist applying for funding to work on like superconductor stuff. And they have to put together like 10 pages on how they're adhering to, you know, diversity, inclusion, and equity. And that is basically a gatekeeper, so that if they're not satisfying that component, then the rest of the application, you know, is just, you know, rejected at the desk. And so, you know, we haven't seen that here. I think I'm still I am a proponent of academic freedom, and I think we still do have that here, although perhaps it might seem like it's a bit muted right now. And in terms of Bitcoin from a technical perspective, I've yet to see anything, you know, sort of negative in that sense. But there's a lot of other topics that academics would like to have their freedom to be able to talk about and publish about, which they can't be so loud.
Yeah, and I think that is challenging. And in a way, I mean, Bitcoin is, I mean, it's truth. You know, you've got the ledger, it's out there. I've got a full node right here next to me. And, you know, that is truth. And I think the larger movement that I've seen in the last few years is that we have emerged, you know, into a post-truth society. And this sounds like a bit of a culture study, but I really feel like, you know, what is truth? What is research? What is rigorous research? All these kinds of questions have been very much challenged. And when I talk to young people, and I'm fortunate enough to kind of have a bit of a connection through my work with the universities, you know, you talk to people coming out of them looking for work and stuff, and you realize, you know, just how much self-censorship, how much sort of the muting of that original thought has come through, and they're sort of parroting these same arguments. And it's almost like it's the opposite of what it should be, which is young people coming out asking questions. And I have found that a little bit concerning. And as I said, you know, I did a bit of Chinese study, and I mean, it's fully captured. You know, they've got the Confucius Institute there. It's run by the Communist Party of China. You're unable to talk about anything of substance within, you know, the context of, say, China. And it's the same with, I think, other political, you know, political studies, all that. It's all very much by the book. And I do find that challenging, you know, and I think as I get older, I think, yeah, we need to be having these talks. I don't know. It feels very fiat, if I was to use a Bitcoin term for it. But
I love it. You know, this dude, Safedean, right? Safedean Amous. He calls it Fiat University, right?
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. The first time I heard him say that, like, it just stuck with me. And like, I'm reminded every day, right, that I work at a Fiat University, you know, and it's not really a knock on the university or anything against that. It's more of, I think, commentary about like our institutions that are around us today. And you know, this idea of bloat, like there's a lot of people doing things that maybe aren't necessary, or they aren't necessarily being productive for the students' needs. And in terms of getting jobs and setting them up for a stable future. And you see it across a lot of institutions. And so this idea of fiat as a derogatory term, I perhaps wouldn't always use it like that, but I recognize that it's there and that I think it has significance, and applying it to a university is one of those things. And, you know, although we must remember that Safedean himself is a product of the Fiat University system, right? He got his PhD at a fancy school in New York. And so he can like go forward using that credential, even though he turns around and sort of highlights all of the issues that are with it.
Yeah. And I think it's also, there is a larger move towards distrust in institutions, I think, whether it's the universities or media or large corporations. I think our faith, and even the government, I think to a larger extent, our faith in institutions has been challenged these last few years. And it's sort of the natural swing of, as the natural cycle of history to go through these periods where, you know, there's a bit of distrust. You know, you saw it in the church historically, you saw it, you know, with different countries and the empire and all of these sort of historical projects. And now we're seeing it more broadly through media, academia, and government. And what does that mean? What does that mean for people coming up? You know, the recipe of success, which is to go to university, get a job, buy a house. I mean, none of those things work anymore. But we're still doing it. It's like this cargo cult of success, right? Like, you got to get the bachelor's degree to get the job to pay off the loan for the bachelor's degree. And I think Bitcoin, in a way, because it's so self-sovereign, it asks you not to just believe something, but to go and verify for yourself. You can do it from home. You can, in fact, if someone's got a MacBook, they've got a copy of the white paper on there already, as I recently found out.
That's pretty crazy. I love a good conspiracy theory, and I was surprised to learn that, and I'm amazed that nobody figured it out until now.
Well, it's the long march of the institution, which has been slowly, we're seeing the outcome of that now, but you know, there is, and I know for sure there are Bitcoiners in high places, not only in New Zealand, but globally. But we tend to just, you know, keep it on the low. And so, yeah, it's, of course, Apple's going to have some Bitcoin on the balance sheet. Of course, they've got people, talking about the stuff, doing this stuff. And, it's a natural evolution of that, I think.
What was it like from the Chinese perspective? Were you talking Bitcoin to people there?
Well, actually, I was down in Christchurch recently for the BitKiwi meetup, and at the Airbnb sort of hostel thing I was staying at, there was a Chinese guy there, and we had a good old chat. And he gets it, you know, because I had this Bitcoin T-shirt on that I won at the meetup from the raffle, and he's like, oh, you know, because that was it, Beats of Beer is the way they say it, and they've got this whole thing, and for them, you know, their paradigm for understanding is very different, because they're already far along the CBDC route, and it would be a good segue to jump into, but yeah, he was straight into it. We were talking about mining. Talking about Bitcoin, talking about sort of the opportunities there, but I'd be super keen to talk about a little bit about CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, and sort of what your thoughts are and sort of where you stand on that.
What a slippery slope. I'm definitely not excited for them. I have looked into them a bit. I gave a presentation on them here at the uni 2 years ago, and my conclusion, and it hasn't changed, but my conclusion was that they're inevitable. And you look around and it does seem like very few people are pumping the brakes on this. I think there was one of the Scandinavian countries threw out their proposal and said, no, we're not going to go down this road. you know, at least right now. And so hopefully that is a trend that continues, that more people, when they get further into their experiments or their projects, will see that, you know, maybe it's not necessary, or there's other things they can do, or that the risks outweigh the rewards. There's like so much chatter though about CBDCs, including right here with the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. And the from a technologist point of view, there's a lot of chatter and there's a lot of like policy papers, but there's almost no innovation. There's almost no research going on, at least as far as I'm aware, at universities that are looking into ways, for example, that you can incorporate privacy into a CBDC. There's obviously definitely a lot of research on privacy itself, but not necessarily in that context. And I think that is going to be a make or break case. It's fine to sit back and watch other people do it, but when it's your own financial privacy that gets leaked in some breach, you know, because you were promised a secure system and it ended up not being that way, then I think we're going to see that there could be a lot of trouble down the road. So I'm generally optimistic. I'm hopeful in the sense that, let's say it happens here, enough people will kind of speak out and say like, look, this is not worth the risk. I don't know how it's going to go down in China. They're well far advanced, and there are a few other projects that are off the ground. One of them is it Bermuda? One of the Caribbean islands, they already have their CBDC up and running. Just before passing it back, right, we need to make a distinction also between a stablecoin type of blockchain system and just a CBDC that now is replacing the digital money system that we use just with our regular banking apps. And again, there's not a lot of, at least publicly, there's not a lot of reports showing that these are the differences and here's what we plan on doing.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I mean, it's quite a timely conversation. Just recently we had the Latitude hack, which was New Zealand and Australia.
Yes, yes.
And a whole lot of personally identifying information, passports, driver's license were leaked or held to ransom, I believe, which goes to show, you know, that's just one company. But if it, you know, if it happens with the entire New Zealand database, what you know, what do we do then? We're going to just do a rollback, you know, do a DAO fork and just roll it all back and change our names. You know, what's the Cody Classic?
Imagine Grant Robertson making that press release?
Yeah, yeah. But sorry, come back to CBDC. So I do agree that there's minimal, and in fact, alarmingly little conversation publicly about this. And I think most people don't even know what a CBDC is. I've certainly been following the Reserve Bank. I walk past it every day, as I tell everyone.
Right.
It's just a building, and I don't think they know what they're doing. They, you know, they put out these papers, but my take, and I did make a submission to their request for feedback. My high level take is that they're not even talking to the public; they're talking to other crown entities. You know, they're all about talking to the FMA. They're all about talking to IRD. That, you know, that's their due diligence and their conversations and their discourse are with other government agencies, and maybe some of the bigger banks are having those conversations as well. But certainly, for what it means for Joe Bloggs on the street, I don't see any media coverage, any engagement. And in fact, one of my sort of points in my response was that I don't even think the Reserve Bank has the capability or the infrastructure to engage publicly. Like, I think other government institutions, MBIE, that sort of thing, they have you know, teams who do engagement, who do canvassing. They can kind of talk to people. But, you know, when was the last time the Reserve Bank had to work out what Kiwis want? You know, so it seems like it's sort of fundamentally the incentives for what they're going to build are flawed. And I also, coming back to the capabilities question, I mean, who's going to do it? And I'd love to sort of talk with you about that and perhaps speculate. But I feel like if anyone's going to do it, it's going to be a large exchange, someone like Binance, who's going to take the technology and just do it. Because I don't see any New Zealand companies being able to build it. I certainly don't think the government can build it. And so does that mean we're now going to have, you know, BNB Smart Chain running the New Zealand dollar Is that a future that we really want?
Oh man, I hadn't considered that one. I'll give the Reserve Bank some credit here. They did put out a video version of their last paper, and you know, they put it on YouTube, public facing on their website. They had two guys just kind of like talking through the points, and like,
yeah,
you're right.
I met JC Summers. He's one of the guys on the video. I mean, I've had a chat.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay. You're right. The MB is sort of a little bit more dialed in, but I think that, you know, we see this from everyone when they're learning about this technology, and especially adults that are time poor that think that we're smart enough to grasp this. At first, we come up the knowledge curve and we're like, oh yeah, you know, this makes sense. I think I have an idea of what is going on there. Then someone taps you and says, hey, can you handle, you know, our Future of Money series? And you go, yeah, I think I know what's going on. And you haven't really had time to come back down and be humbled by what you don't yet know, and then sort of make the slow, steady climb again. And so I think that there's a lot of good intentions, but man, we don't want, you know, basically intentions messing with our monetary system. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot of really just hardcore blockchain experience.
Oh, well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's just a building. It's you know, however many hundreds, if not thousands of people I've got working for them. And so getting them to then also go and do this other thing, I feel like it's way out of scope. And fundamentally, the hubris and the kind of the tūranga waiwai, you know, the place of standing that they're in, they already control the money. They can kind of do whatever they want. They're not even the government, you know, they're a state entity, but they're not, yep. You know, they're not democratically elected. At the very least, and look, I use MBIE as an example, but it is a mega ministry. It's like, it's all of the ministries, right? Like, it does all things. But at least, you know, if there's a change of regime, then, you know, those people, the executives get swapped out. There's a bit of a change in tact. But whereas the Reserve Bank, it's like literally, you know, statutorily independent. It does its own thing. So it's like, it's undemocratic at its core. And yet, you know, you look at the paraphernalia that they have in their lobby. They've got Tāne Mahuta, you know, the giant kauri tree. They talk about being custodians, kaitiaki of the money.
That's right.
And it's like, yeah, you can just like, you know, call yourself the king and say you're going to look after everyone, but you're just sort of, I don't know, that position, that feels like it's a flawed position. And it also comes back to some deeper issues, actually, even about the treaty and looking at monetary sovereignty. But like, what under what position and by what authority are you able to set these mandates for yourself? I feel like that's sort of, there's a bit of a political kind of philosophical challenge there. Like, who gave you the right to change the money, you know?
I had two main criticisms. I had two main points in my submission that I took out from that. And one of them has to do with what you just mentioned. It's like, who gives you the right? They say that one of their mandates is to preserve the trust that Kiwis have in the monetary system. And they also phrase it in such a way that implies that they're the ones that gave us the trust in the system, that they're the ones that created the trust in the system. And so I push back straight away and I'm like, look, trust is a social contract and you cannot mandate trust no matter what you do. You have to, you know, maintain it through relationships, good behavior. It takes time. You know, we see this all the time with companies, you know, with branding and when they lose their trust and things like this. And trust in a monetary system, first of all, it has to be earned. And secondly, Kiwis right now definitely do not trust the monetary system, right? Like it's not a cliche anymore. You go to the grocery store and you're cursing.
Yeah.
So that was my first, like right off the bat, the premise that they're the ones responsible for trust. I'm like, no, you absolutely are not. You are privileged to be in a position such that we have this arrangement between us as like citizens and as like a mega ministry, as you said. And the second thing is just all about the status quo. It doesn't seem like there's a lot there that they're willing to disrupt the current system by making any changes. And I think that if you are going to either embrace some blockchain innovation or look to make changes in your monetary system, you have to be willing that there could be some bumps along the road. And this goes back to your point about you don't really know where the banks stand. Well, the banks are set to be disintermediated. And so like this has been a criticism, or this has been a potential issue from day one with CBDCs.
Yeah. And coming back to, you know, the mandate where they stand to actually do this stuff, they're kind of, I mean, they're in their own ivory tower of hubris, where they can sort of sit there. Again, it's a building. It's not an infallible structure. And in fact, you see some of the people waddling in there in the morning, you think, man, are these the ones who are causing us to have a cost of living crisis? Because, you know, if you're going to be kaitiaki, if you're going to be a guardian of the money, then what the heck are you doing putting the interest rates up 50 basis points, which is killing low income families' purchasing power? It's putting a lot of first homeowners underwater. That's literally like you're breaking the thing, and it's all connected, because if you hadn't printed the money in the first place, we wouldn't have had to do this tightening. And it's like that sort of plane of existence that they're on, and in New Zealand, because we're a small country, and you know, that's relatively accessible. In bigger places like the US, you know, that's kind of almost godlike, you know, how much power they wield, you know, the Fed.
That's right.
You know, and they're from their pulpit, they come and announce, you know, they proclaim the new interest rate, it shall be. And it's literally fiat, you know, let it be, let them eat cake. And I think that sort of revolutionary thought, I mean, that's really hard to grok if you're in the government. It's like, well, you know, what's the future look like? I think what it is we knock down that building at number two, the terrace, and we run a Bitcoin node, and that's it, you know. Like that's our monetary future. And I think to kind of try and negotiate a middle ground, it's like, yeah, we're dancing and we've got the quicksand, but that is the future, and you're just sort of rearranging chairs on the Titanic, I believe. And I mean, that's a very hardline view, but in the long run, I think there's no other alternative.
It's hard to argue against that view, though, and like it's a bit maybe apocalyptic, but on the positive side, these things tend to happen slowly, and we'll have time to adapt. But it seems to be, like you say, the only way out of this. Certainly, nobody's going to tear down a building and put up a Bitcoin node. although maybe like a smaller nation state, we'll get Balaji to start one, can do that.
Yeah.
And so the only way out is to just keep on printing, right? And it's going to be a race between everyone to, I don't even know how it plays out. I'm not a macro guy. I listen to macro podcasts for entertainment, not for study.
I still don't understand how bonds work. So I'm in the same boat. I'm a bit of a numpty with that. But I tell you though, what I do know is I have a little money printer right here next to me. It keeps my office warm. And so it's like, well, we got the Reserve Bank, we've got the Treasury up the road, but you know, hey, I got my own one now as well. And I think there's something quite, I mean, beautifully peaceful about that though. So I'm not fighting. You know, I don't even want to fight. I don't even want to go down that road. I know where that goes. I read philosophy, I read history. That is not the answer. What the answer is peaceful, a peaceful change. And I think what's hard is what you're talking about is like, while we're in the room with the patient, we're discussing, you know, funeral arrangements, you know, and when it comes to the Reserve Bank, we're talking about, you know, what does the end of central banking look like? And as you say, you know, you're trying to posit this criticism that, hey, you know, who gives you the mandate to even set monetary policy and to change the way we do things. It's this kind of, you're challenging their core assumptions and their raison d'etre, like why are they even here? And that's like, you can't really articulate that easily in a response for feedback. It's like they're asking us to tell them something and we're saying, hey, actually, you're not even qualified to ask that question.
Yeah, especially in the Bitcoin, or even to use a worse word, in the crypto climate, right? You can't start to bring these things up. This is antithetical, you know, to the foundation that all these buildings were raised upon. You know, I watch what's happening in the there's a Bitcoin Telegram group I'm sure you're a part of, and I've been watching what's happening with the responses to the RBNZ's proposal in there, and there's, you know, a lot of good ideas and a lot of thoughts about what we can do and about this thing called Bitcoin. But we know that that's not going to get any traction. You know, it's the wrong language. It's the wrong premise. And it's coming from the wrong people, right? Coming from the public. You know, I don't see that necessarily being advantageous.
Yeah, and I guess I do want to drill into that a little bit, because I recently went to a Binance meetup across the road from the Reserve Bank, They had, I think Binance New Zealand had announced that they're now a thing. They've been given authority to operate in New Zealand. And so I believe they're now the largest international exchange to have a presence, a local presence in New Zealand. And what I found really concerning was that, you know, effectively, and this is where I met JC Summers, you know, from the Reserve Bank. I had a chat with him. And I was like, look, you know, you've got Binance, which has got clear ties with China, with the US, you know, their work, you know, in terms of law enforcement, in terms of monitoring, censoring. I mean, it's pretty clear and major track record. And not to, you know, not to mention the wash trading allegations that have come up recently, but you've got the, you know, Binance basically pitching to senior policy advisors from the RBNZ. And their slideshow that they presented, you know, it wasn't like, you know, here's our next shitcoin. It was like, here's how much law enforcement workshops we've done. Here's how much compliance we've done. You know, they're kind of trying to say the keywords that gets the, you know, would tick the Reserve Bank's box. And I'm, you know, I'm curious about this because I know you on your podcast you had Ben Rose, GM from Binance.
Yes.
I mean, what was your take? I mean, it seems like they're quite a young organization in New Zealand.
They're brand new. Are you kidding me? Like, yeah. Ben left his last gig probably about a year ago now, and he just took on more responsibility. The head of Binance Australia stepped down, and so they just gave it to Ben. And so now he's got Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands to run Binance's operations. Now, really, I don't have any inside info, but from my point of view, right there, they have a home anchored here in New Zealand. And of course, they want to play nice with the regulators. They want to be seen as an equal partner in the finance game, playing with the playing as a registered financial service provider. And so far, they are, and that's fine. But whether or not that's going to be taken to a next level, what's the next level? Well, in my view, the next level is being able to trade derivatives or have some leverage trading or being able to trade these more exotic products that you cannot do through Binance New Zealand. And, you know, who knows how long or if that's going to happen. But one of the interesting things that Ben said was that they had to have an office in order to be an entity here in New Zealand. Otherwise, they might not have even landed here. So they do have a real office. He said, like most people, you know, work remotely anyways, but we do have a physical office, which was a requirement. You know, outside of Binance New Zealand, another thing about Binance, right, is that we don't know where their headquarters is located. They have, you know, no official.
Who are they? Like
headquartered location. Yeah. Like they used to be in Malta, right, back in 2016, 17, 18. But then they kind of had to go into the shadows. And so whatever they were doing in Malta, they had to, I don't know what happened. I'm speculating here, but that relationship went sour. And, you know, so they're somewhere else now, but, you know, like New Zealand's only one of less than 10 entities where they have an office location worldwide.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess what concerned me as well, you know, coming in, so I went in and I thought, hey, you know, it's just up the road. I'll go pop my head in. Maybe there's some cool Bitcoiners there. But what really struck me was just the change in vibe. And if I was to compare it with, say, the BitKiwi meetups that we had a couple of weeks before that, where it's like, hey, people are bringing in stuff they've made. People brought in their nodes. You know, one guy had a Bitcoin ATM that he had built. You know, very much a cool, chill vibe. You know, I don't think price was even mentioned once in our meetups here in Wellington. And then I went to the Binance meetup and it was like, wow, there was just something in the air. You know, and I was chatting with guys and I was like, hey, you know, so you self-custodying? Like, how are you doing? And they're like, no, I keep it in Binance. I was like, how could you possibly do that after FTX, after Celsius, after all of these exchanges and issues that we've seen over the last few years? How could you possibly still trust the OG shitcoin casino? And I use that word, you know, being straight up about it. You know, how can you still trust these places with your value? And I was like, you know, so you're interested in Bitcoin? And they're like, oh no, Bitcoin, that's too slow. Doesn't work. I was like, have you heard of the Lightning Network? You know, and you see what I mean? And I was like, oh my God, I got myself into the wrong place. At least there was some free food and free drinks, which are obviously subsidized by some yield product that they had made. But you know what I mean? It was like, how could you still believe this?
And you're right. The vibe is way different, isn't it? And it's money. There's more money there. Binance has a lot that they can throw around. I don't know. I'm all right with it, right? The money comes from people gambling.
Yeah.
And you want to gamble? That's terrific. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the big difference, right? Is like, you know, that get rich quick, that vibe. You know, there was a couple of guys that I was talking to. I was like, man, are you okay? You know, like, just, you know, the intensity they had, you know, and they were talking about their bags and stuff, and it was like, yo, man, just
yeah, you know. It's depressing, right? And maybe not depressing on the surface, but if you follow that trail to its conclusion, like, you can be worried about people. Look, I met with someone today. He's interested in like learning about blockchain. He wants to perhaps do a part-time master's here at AET. So he found me and we met today. And this came up, this idea of talking about like centralized exchanges and what you do. And I was like, so trying to get a gauge for how deep he was in. And he was on Coinbase. He's like, yeah, so I've basically bought the top on Coinbase and I'm just waiting for it to go back up. He's like, I also have Binance, but I don't use it as in like the app on his phone. But my point here is that I'm not even sure anyone had brought up the idea of self-custody with him yet. And he was very interested in learning more about the tech, but he was still just at like, here's what I've got. It's on my phone.
Yeah. And I think that it's a journey that we all go through. And I think it's challenging. And certainly, and that was something that JC Summers said to me. He said, Cody, who are you affiliated with? And I said, hey, I'm a Bitcoiner. You know, I'm affiliated with myself. And I think that even just that paradigm is very challenging because institutions are used to dealing with companies and organizations. You know, who's the CEO of Bitcoin? You know, who can I talk to? Where's the contact details? You know, and it doesn't work like that. And so we don't have a marketing budget in Bitcoin. There's no real centralized sources. You know, there's a lot of decentralized stuff. But, you know, if you want to find out what to do, it's a lot easier to fall into the centralized exchange trap. And, you know, then you're in their system. And it's like kind of fiat with all the, you know, all the negatives of fiat and none of the positives. Of at least having a system that you know, you can still use cash and things like that, but in the Binance world, you know, none of that is available, and one day they might just go offline and rug you. And I think that's one of the challenges. But I mean, eventually the truth emerges, right? And Bitcoin is still here 13-14 years later. I mean, you're doing your work, you know, hopefully, you know, sharing that the Bitcoin Genesis story with students. There's other people out there. I'm running this podcast, so I think there are people out there. But I mean, who knows? It's going to take a while, perhaps, to disseminate that information.
Well, it's decentralized, right? It's a brand new paradigm in how this whole thing perhaps can work. I still call it an experiment from time to time, right? It's still young. We don't know what it's like. But you can look at like the benefits of having decentralized structure like this, and like we had this revolution in the idea of digital scarcity. Right. I'll bang on about this all day to my students is that like we've never had this in any network in human history before. Now, we haven't had digital networks for very long, but still, this is the first time that we've ever had that. And, you know, really, you can do anything you want with that as long as you play by the rules, which have been set out. And if the rules don't work, well, listen, you're free to go start your own as well and tweak the rules or change the rules slightly. And so. As a distributed system, you know, that wasn't possible before. And the other bit about decentralization is that, like you mentioned, with the institutions, they're not equipped. They're not. There's no process that they're equipped to handle this stuff with. You know, there's no flowchart, right?
Yeah, and I think that's sort of the other kind of nuance is that. I mean, certainly as I've gone through my sort of journey understanding Bitcoin, you know, I was thinking, oh, you know, we can use the ledger for all things, you know, and that, you know, it's something a lot of people come to. And it, in a way, you know, that is actually emerging now where you're seeing things like Liquid, RGB, Taro, these kind of layer two, layer three protocols, which kind of build upon the decentralized fundamentals of Bitcoin, but can be used for other things. I still feel like money is really the only one that's, you know, that's got, you know, the value is just orders of magnitude above everything else. But, you know, are there other things in terms of freedom of, you know, freedom of speech, you know, for example, inscribing text and information and into the ledger, things like that, you know, kind of these edge cases, which I think are worth talking about and exploring. But have you found, just with the failings of Ethereum and proof of stake, have you seen opportunities with some of these other emerging layer two, layer three tech stacks on top of Bitcoin?
Like aside from Lightning?
Yeah, aside from Lightning. So Liquid, RGB, Taro, a lot of them are quite early days.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't looked into those at all. I'm versed in Lightning, but I'm not even well versed in Lightning.
Yeah.
Right. So
it's changing every day. Yeah.
There's a lot to do with that. I'd keen to get your practical experience, because I know that you stream this on Fountain. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of that, like the first time that I used Lightning was in my class last year, we did a lecture on how the Lightning network works as a layer two on Bitcoin. And you know, part of that was Lightning wallets and sending Satoshis around in class to the students that were there and wanted to participate. And from my point of view, that went super well because it worked.
What wallet did you use? I'm curious.
I had Wasabi on my iPad and I had Moon Wallet on my Android. And I asked the students to pick whether or not they wanted to download either one of those if they wanted to participate.
Yeah, I think I can recommend Wallet Satoshi is really good as well for getting people online real quick. I was talking to someone on a call the other day, and I said, look, just download Wallet Satoshi, because it goes straight away. As soon as you install the app, you can just receive on Lightning, which is really powerful. But it's cool that you did the experiment in class where you were able to send Lightning between each students.
Yeah, we did it in class. And actually, I tried it a year before that, but we were in lockdown, right? And so I was like holding a QR code up to the screen, like ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
So my perspective, sort of the way, the lens that I've developed for looking at it, is Lightning is extremely powerful, and it really enables these microtransactions. And so I always look at it, you know, in terms of micro and macro transactions. And so with my podcast, people are able to listen to that stream, you know, 1 Satoshi, 10 Satoshis per minute, or they can boost the show. And it really is this kind of bigger transformative move towards value for value, which is sort of trying to break the fiat mindset, which seems to have, you know, come through in a lot of places online as well. You know, like, what does like even mean? It's pretty empty. It's kind of fiat thinking. But actually, you know, if I like what you're doing, I'm going to actually send you a little bit of value as a bit of a token amount to sort of signify that. And I think there's some things there which older people might struggle with, but I reckon Gen Z and younger people, for them, it's going to be totally natural to do that. But yeah, Lightning's certainly very powerful. And, you know, I've used it to buy coffees here in Wellington. I've used it for dinner. We all went out down in Christchurch for the BitKiwi meetup. We paid it with Lightning at a restaurant. So it's kind of emerging. But as you know, the history of money, I mean, using it actually as a medium of exchange comes a little bit later. You know, it starts off as a store of value for a long time. So I don't think we're quite there yet. New Zealand, I mean, FPOS kind of sucks. I went to buy some milk yesterday and FPOS didn't work, so I had to bust out some cash. But
yeah.
For the most part, for most people, you know, that's not enough of a pain point to really change their actions drastically.
And what are some of these newer or more, what are some of these more immature layer twos? What should I be looking up to tell my students?
I'm not particularly versed in them either myself. I mean, RGB is one, Liquid is another, and then Taro, T-A-R-O, are kind of the three that I read a little bit about. But they look, and then the other one to look at would be Fedimint, as a way of doing, you know, Chalmi and eCash, I guess they call it, but, you know, custodial money within a community. So, you know, you can have someone who sort of takes ownership of it, think of it like a bank, and then everyone who uses that Fedimint token is kind of like a token on Bitcoin. And I'm probably going to get a bit of flack for saying that, but it means, you know, you can have, you know, Kodi dollars, and they're actually, you know, Satoshis, and you can operate within a walled garden with that, and then you can always peg back out to Bitcoin at the end.
Okay. Fedi as in federated?
Yeah. F-E-D-I, yeah. Fedi Mint. So I've had a little bit of a play with that. There's a few other things in that space, but I mean, it's moving so quickly. And then if you throw in Nostra to the mix, and it's like, yeah, everything's happening. It's pretty hard to keep up, to be honest.
And what about privacy in terms of, let's take the podcast as a business case. What's the privacy that either is provided by the app, or how do you manage that? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, well, in terms of transactions.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think obviously the base chain Bitcoin, you know, it is pseudo anonymous. If you know who owns an address, you can sort of follow them. But I think, you know, we're in a short period of time where normal people are going to have access to UTXOs. I think most people in the future are going to have, whether it's a Fedi Mint or a Lightning custodial solution, I think most people will use the ANZ Lightning Wallet or the Westpac Lightning Wallet if, you know, those banks are able to pivot, which I don't know if they will be able to. But that will be what, you know, the average consumer uses. And then these larger, you know, transactions will be on the blockchain. And so with Lightning, you know, there's a lot more privacy there. You know, you don't have that visibility. That's public, like the base chain. And so I think that's like a non-issue. I haven't had any issues with that myself. Though I think there are some privacy fundamentals for buying, you know, Bitcoin straight on the blockchain that is, you need to, you know, make sure you're not reusing addresses. You might need to make sure you're not sharing your public key and things like that, that people, you know, need to follow. But again, I don't think that's going to be for everyone in the world. I think that's going to be for early adopters and for large institutions eventually, to be using that mode of engagement.
I mean, it's interesting that you see as like, maybe not like you say at ANZ, but at Lightning Bank, it's kind of like a blend of a place people know and a place that works well, only in the back end, it's actually Lightning transactions or something like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Wallet of Satoshi is pretty much already a bank, you know, like, and I think we're seeing that innovation slowly creep through. I mean, it's a very regulated sector, but when I started my business, I was like, okay, what am I going to do for a bank account? I tried ringing up ANZ. They wanted me to come in. They wanted to put me on hold for an hour. And I was like, man, stuff this. And I ended up just going with TransferWise. And I mean, that's still a legacy bank, but man, it was so much easier. And I think the next step from that will be like, well, actually, we'll just use Wallet of Satoshi or some other, you know, Lightning wallet. And I think if banks are innovative and they pivot and they see the change, I think they could be successful, but they could also not do that. And they're going to try and hold on to it. And the brand, I don't even know if the brand has value anymore. You know, I think the way I always think about it is if you travel to another country and you see some random ATM with some random bank name on it, you have zero trust for that. You know, is it even a real ATM? You know, you're in some dodgy country. I think it's going to be the same with banks here. It's like, oh, ANZ, man, what's this thing on the road where I get this paper money from? You know, I don't think the brand will hold that same value that it has with older people today. And especially if you look at the marketing, I mean, who are they talking to when they talk about home loans? Because they're not talking to my generation.
You know what? Segue here, or short sidebar here. You know what ANZ did, right? I watched these commercials on TV.
What's a TV?
This is where people always tell me, oh, they don't watch TV, and I'm like, that's fine. So ANZ advertising their home loans, right? They've got this like great series where like the son like makes the cricket team, and like it's the whole family, and they do different things, right? And like the media is done really well; it's quite compelling. And the dude shows his phone showing the state of their mortgage. So a year ago, the mortgage said it was $47,000 remaining, right? And the guy goes, it's almost out the door. And I'm like, oh, what a good line. I love television marketing. And so meaning they had $47,000 left to pay. Now they run the same commercial and they've changed the screenshot on his phone. And now he has $147,000 left to pay. Right. And so that's the state of housing. That's the state of the economy right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always think of those ads and it's like, all right, you've got some people with a nice big house, they've got a couple of kids, they've got a dog, a boat, And I'm thinking, man, I'm sitting here selling my chair to buy Bitcoin. And that's, I think that's the difference. You know, they are the legacy institution, and look, they can have that hubris. You know, they've been around for a long time, but they will need to pivot, as all banks will. And I think I see banks becoming service providers. I think there will always be a need for credit. You know, if you want to build a business, you want to start something new. And if, frankly, if you're not comfortable, you know, being self-sovereign and taking custody of your money, you know, maybe you'll be happy with a Fedimint type setup where there's a, you know, kind of a trusted third party for, your banking services. But at the end of the day, your money will, you know, is redeemable for Bitcoin. And so there is that kind of underlying value proposition and backing of that, that token. And look, they might even print cash. You know, you might be able to get wallet of Satoshi bucks that you can use in your wallet and things like that. But I think there's a long, it's sort of a crystal ball of what that might look like. But I don't see things going back to the way they were. I think the change is inevitable. And as younger people grow up and they come up through this system, they're going to think, man, what is this? Just like the way we might look at a post office or any other legacy institution.
And, you know, institutions don't last, and like, we have to be all right with that. You know, that's okay. They have a limited time. You know, the corporation companies don't last either. In some countries they can be like 400 years old, but like, we're not Japan, and like, you know, or we're not, I don't know, Switzerland. I don't even know if they have old companies in Switzerland, but I know that Japan has some really, really old companies, and like, that's okay. Like, there's the graph of all the changes in, global reserve currencies, right? And the average is about 250 years in modern times that a currency can maintain that status. And so like, change is coming, change is perfectly fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think 250 is more the actual empire that is underwriting that. But okay. in terms of fiat, I think there's only two that have lasted more than 100 years or so. Even New Zealand, our New Zealand dollar didn't come in until the 60s. Yep. It was a New Zealand pound before that. So it's like the actual lineage of currencies, the US dollar and the pound. And it's also a matter of definition. I mean, the US dollar isn't what it used to be, as we all know, since 1971. So, absolutely. It's like the forest. You know, every now and then you need a forest fire to clear out the old growth to allow new growth to come through. And I think that's a natural course of events, and it's actually very healthy. And especially when it's a peaceful changeover, it's one that's negotiated, it's opt-in, it's basically a consensus from the people. And I think that's what we're seeing emerge now. So it's sort of early days. And there will be antagonists along the way who are trying to make a quick buck. And, you know, you're going to have these centralized exchanges. You're going to have places like Binance who are going to try and, do their next coin offerings and yield products and whatever. But look, that's all just a footnote. I think really the value that we're looking at is Bitcoin. It's just a matter of time, I think.
And so do you see it as an opt-out? You mentioned about peaceful protests, right? Is this an opt-out, or is it a peaceful protest, or is it both?
I think it's both. You know, it's like, look, we never had optionality until now. And as I was saying to someone else, you know, a good friend of mine moved from Zimbabwe to New Zealand when he was 15 years old. And, you know, he gave me a $500 million Zimbabwe dollar, and now I'm a millionaire now. And, there was no other option. They fled with what they could carry on their body, basically, and jewelry and things like that. And they really suffered for that. And I think now, though, we have an option, and we can say, well, look, actually, I'm not really happy with the way the Reserve Bank or the monetary system works as a whole. I'm going to look at this other thing. I'm going to run a miner. I'm going to run a node. I'm going to meet with other Bitcoiners. I'm going to build a Bitcoin business. And that's just me. And then you're kind of just doing your own thing. And if the government wants to kind of get involved with that, you know, they can try. But unlike gold and other things, you know, you can't confiscate it. You can't really do much about it. It's pretty peaceful. And I think if enough people do that over time, and because of the cumulative effects of the halvenings and that, more people come in for the number go up technology. They think, oh, Bitcoin's going up in price, I should get a little bit. And then that one thing leads to another, and suddenly everyone's on board. And then it just switches over, and they kind of have to wake up. And I think that's the moment where it's like, oh, actually, we no longer have the power to do anything. We might as well just accept it and start running that full node from the Reserve Bank main office up on the terrace.
Yeah.
Yeah. But hey, Jeff, that might be a good spot to rip out and finish up. I appreciate and I'm conscious of your time, but it was a good, I think we covered a lot of stuff today.
Yeah, I think we did. It flowed a little bit better than I expect. I tend to have difficulty in talks like this, piecing together thoughts and not pausing too much.
That's all good, man. I think it's great to be able to, I mean, you've got an engineering background, you're sort of more about that, the fundamentals and that with the technology, and I guess I'm a bit more creative and out there, so it's a great combo to bring those two together. And I really appreciate the work you're doing. I think I'm not sure if there's anywhere else, any other tertiary institutions in New Zealand where students get to see the white paper on day one and learn about the Lightning Network and share some stats. I think that's pretty cool, and I mean I'd love to see more of that. I think I haven't really seen, certainly just on the media that I follow, people talking about that, so I think, kapai to that, and thank you for doing that.
You're most welcome. And I would love to see more of it as well. There's an opportunity here for all sorts of schools and institutions to, get in, take the lead, and, teach about this alternate system that, has gained so much traction worldwide.
Yeah. Sweet. Well, hey, look, Jeff, I appreciate your time, and I do hope we can catch up again, perhaps next time in person. I'm not sure if you ever get down this way very much, but if I'm in Auckland as well, we could perhaps do something. But I feel like there's more for us to cover, but for the moment, we might wrap it up there.
Thank you very much, Cody.
All right. Thanks. All right. Take care, mate.
Cheers.